And today's word is taken from Matthew chapter 17, verse 14 to 20. When they came to the crowd, a man approached Jesus and knelt before him. "Lord, have mercy on my son," he said. "He has seizures and is suffering greatly. He often falls into the fire or into the water. I brought him to your disciples, but they could not heal him." "You unbelieving and perverse generation," Jesus replied. "How long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." Jesus rebuked the demon, and it came out of the boy, and he was healed at that moment. Then the disciples came to Jesus in private and asked, "Why couldn't we drive it out?" He replied, "Because you have so little faith. Truly, I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, 'Move from here to there,' and it will move. Nothing will be impossible for you." The word of the Lord.
Good morning, everyone. How are you guys doing this morning? Good. For those who don't know me, my name is Lindsay. I work for an organization called Sojourn as a campus minister at Boston University. And I'll be filling in for Katie while she's out on vacation for the next couple weeks. Very well-deserved vacation. So we're glad that she gets a chance to get away with her family. I have been here a few times before, so I love spending these Sundays with you all. I always just feel really welcomed here, so I do love when I get to be here with you guys this morning, so thanks for having me. All right, so there's a lot happening in this very short passage that Rosemary read for us this morning. We have a demon-possessed child, which may or may not be the term for epilepsy, question mark. There's a scared father and a big crowd. There's disciples who are very confused about their lack of abilities. There's a frustrated Jesus. There's a miraculous healing. There's talk of mountains moving. And this is all coming off the heels of the transfiguration, which, you know, is when Jesus went up to the top of a mountain with three of his disciples, and they watched as he was transfigured into his full godly glory. So, yeah, a lot is going on. So where do you even start with a passage like this? And that's a great question that I am still trying to figure out. But usually when I like prep for a sermon, I will start literally by Googling the passage, just basic search. I usually read through like Wikipedia, different blogs, sermons by others. I try to get as many points of views on the passage as I can get. Really try to see if there's anything that I'm missing or misinterpreting, you know, making sure I'm not too far off. And usually through this process, I can kind of start to see a thread emerge, something that keeps sticking out to me amongst everybody else's words. It may not be what they're actually saying, but maybe it's, you know, the things that are touching my heart in a particular way stand out to me more than others. And from there, I can usually piece together the message that God is trying to tell me. That did not happen with this message. Yeah, that was great. So I did take notes and I did read the blogs and all the things, listen to sermons. But honestly, it was just either kind of repeats of everything else or very left turn area that I did not want to go down. So nothing was really helping me to hear God's voice through all of this. But there was one word that just kind of kept coming back to me that had really nothing to do with what I was reading. Actually, the first time Katie sent me this passage to speak on today, I did have this flash of a TV clip that I had recently watched. So fun fact about me, I'm a big fan of reality TV. My all-time favorite is MTV's The Challenge, which is like half competition show, half reality show. My younger sister and I have been watching it together for like 20 years, so we are very invested. We have never met any of these people, but we are very invested in their lives. So recently, I was rewatching an old season, and there was this challenge where it was a pair of teammates, and they had to jump off this cliff into a water, and then swim into a cave, and find a puzzle piece, and then swim to a boat, and be dragged ashore, and then finish the puzzle. Also, a lot going on in that moment. But the part I was remembering was at the very start of the competition, they're standing on this cliff edge, and one of the teammates is absolutely having an intense panic attack. Like, he is screaming his head off, he's crying, he's vomiting, like everything, because he's just so afraid of the heights. And it was pretty comical because it wasn't that high. And he was also the first one to go, so he's just like panicking. But usually in this show, there's a handful of people who react the same way. And if you've ever watched the show, like at least half of the competitions involve heights. So there's always a moment of freak out, and a lot of times somebody will refuse to participate. And it doesn't matter that they're in harnesses or that they're like not that high up, so they like the odds of getting hurt are very low, or that there might be a net below them, or, you know, they're winning $1 million. Like, nothing will get these people to jump. So as I was thinking about this clip, I honestly just assumed it was my ADD, so I just kind of moved past it. But then as I was sitting in this passage, that image just kept coming back and kept coming back. And then I started to finally, like, kind of piece the words together, and it became a little bit more clear that, like, it's fear holding them back. They're afraid and they cannot trust. So all of that to say, this morning we are talking about trust and fear. So here's the thing. Fear can look a lot of different ways. It can look like having a panic attack on the side of a cliff when you're asked to jump into the water. It can also look like a father begging for his son to be healed. But it can also look a lot more subtle than that. It can look a lot like the question, why couldn't I do it? When the disciples pull Jesus aside and ask this question, why couldn't we drive it out? I hear fear in those words. I hear the fear of failure. I hear the fear of looking foolish, getting it wrong. The fear that you gave everything up to follow this man and his promises. But what if those promises aren't true? When we talk about the things that we're afraid of, we often talk about things like heights, or maybe it's spiders, or flying, or public speaking, or tight spaces. But the ones that we don't talk about are often the ones that actually hold us back from living, and are much more realistic than a clown chasing after you. Unless you remember 2016, where this was our reality. What a great time to be alive. The real fears that can cause us to change the way we interact with life are things like abandonment, losing the people closest to us, not measuring up, failing. These are the fears that I hear in this question, why couldn't I do it? Jesus, why couldn't I do what I've seen you done before? Why couldn't I do what you have taught me to do? Why wasn't I good enough? Why am I not enough? I mean, that's a question that I'm sure most of us are all too familiar with, right? I mean, I've spent the last few weeks asking that exact same question and being terrified of the answers that I might find on the other side. But I also think about what I would do if I were in the disciple situation. I mean, for me, when I feel in over my head or stressed out, I get like super anxious. And when I get anxious, I get really rigid and I hold on tighter to whatever plan I've formed to get me through the situation I'm in. Good plan or not, I'm holding on to it. See, fear makes us hold on tighter. We're unwilling to let go. Whereas trust allows us to approach things with an open hand. Like when I feel safe and comfortable in a situation, or when I'm with people that I trust, even if the setting is unfamiliar or the scene is chaotic, I find I'm much more willing to approach things open-handed. But that also means that I have to let myself be vulnerable, because fear hates vulnerability. Opening ourselves up to vulnerability means opening ourselves up to the possibility of getting it wrong, to not measuring up, to getting hurt, to failing. But it also opens ourselves up to deeper relationships and growth and self-awareness. Now, don't get me wrong, I don't think that fear and trust are opposites. They can coexist. I think you can still show trust while being deeply afraid. The question isn't, are you afraid or do you trust? The question is, which one are you letting drive your decisions? When we let fear drive our decisions, we close that fist tighter, not letting anything else get in or get out. But when we let trust drive our decisions, even when we're deeply afraid of what might happen, we let some light into that space, and little by little, that hand becomes open and ready to receive. And just as fear is not the opposite of trust, I also don't think that fear is the same thing as doubt. And while they walk a similar line and can feed into one another, I do think that they are different. Has anybody seen that video of like a little girl on her porch? She's trying to pet a dog, but it's actually a bear. And like her mom kind of, you've seen it, yeah? her mom like grabs her out of reach, you know, and into safety, but she's very adamant that she wants to pet the dog, but it's a bear. So when fear is healthy, it can keep us from doing things that bring us harm, like petting bears. But when it's unhealthy, it can keep us from doing things that might actually bring us life. But when doubt is unhealthy, it makes us question that we are made in God's image and deeply loved by our Creator and others. When it's healthy, it can help us ask important questions that lead us deeper into God's loving arms and affirm that we are wonderfully and beautifully made. Throughout Scripture, we see people time and time again doubting God, doubting themselves, doubting the miracles that are right in front of them. As I said earlier, this story comes immediately following the transfiguration of Jesus. So for those who don't know that story, have zero idea what I'm talking about, here's kind of the SparkNotes version. So Jesus takes three of his disciples, Peter, James, and John, up to the top of a mountain. And while they're there, they watch him literally transform. The Message version says it this way. His appearance changed from the inside out right before their eyes. Sunlight poured from his face. His clothes were filled with light. Then they realized that Moses and Elijah were also there in deep conversation with him. So yeah, Moses and Elijah, you know, the prophets that died like a really, really, really long time ago. They're just hanging out and chatting with Jesus. No big deal. So then after that, they heard the voice of God say this. This is my son, marked by my love, focus of my delight. Listen to him. So again, crazy stuff is kind of happening. And then our passage from today picks up this same story with at the bottom of the mountain. So when I say this immediately follows the transfiguration, I mean that literally. These three disciples just had this incredible experience of Jesus' holiness, and then they turn around to see the other nine going, so I'm not really sure what's wrong, but whatever we're doing isn't working. So then Jesus rebukes them by saying, you unbelieving and perverse generation, how long shall I stay with you? How long shall I put up with you? But the Message puts it a little different. It puts it like this. How many times do I have to go over these things? How much longer do I have to put up with this? So in this one, I hear this not so much as like this angry outburst, but more as this like frustrated, like, how many times do I have to go over this, right? Like that teacher who just went over the homework like 18 times, and then the very next question is, what's the homework? Like, how many times? But then I look at those nine disciples, And along with their fear of failure that I read into this, I also see a lot of doubt. These were the nine that didn't go up the mountain. These were the ones that were left behind. If you're already doubting that you aren't good enough, that might turn the volume up on those voices just a little bit. Maybe they decided to try and heal this boy to prove to themselves and to everybody else that they were good enough. Maybe this was their attempt to show that they belonged with Peter, James, and John. And then it didn't work. The boy was still seizing. The father was still panicking. The crowd is starting to feel super awkward. I mean, if I were them, the imposter syndrome would be screaming so loud in that moment. Every voice telling me that I'm not, in fact, good enough, and that I was, in fact, a failure and a fraud. Those voices would be on full blast. See, doubt and fear go hand in hand, but they are different things. I do see both happening in this moment. But like I said, doubt can also be really good. It can push us to ask hard questions and find real answers. It can help us walk away from unhealthy situations and draw us near to healthy spaces. Our doubts can actually draw us deeper into our faith instead of taking us farther away. When Jesus rose from the dead and appeared to his disciples, Thomas famously doubted. I mean, that is literally his legacy, which, by the way, I think is totally unfair because, like, everybody in the Bible doubted. But, yeah, like, they were doubting God, they were doubting themselves, they were doubting others. So I'm not sure why this label landed on Thomas, but here we are. So Thomas's doubts, though, they also allowed him to have an experience with the resurrected Jesus that nobody else had. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." You know, it is kind of funny to me that so many of the stories of doubt in the Bible come fairly shortly after miraculous things. I mean, even the miracles don't prevent doubts from forming. But Thomas's doubts didn't pull him away from God. It brought him close enough to touch. When we stop trying to safeguard ourselves against doubts and instead lean into them, we can discover new ways of seeing and being with God that are a million times better than what we could have ever imagined. Doubt and faith are not at odds. Just like fear, the issues arise when we let doubts drive our decisions and dictate how we see ourselves and others. When we give final say to the voices that ask, "Are you sure I'm the right person for this?" then we've denied the voice of God that says, "I'm with you always." And when we choose to follow the voice of, "What if I'm not good enough?" then we're ignoring the one who says, "You are perfectly and wonderfully made." The honest truth is that we may not be the right person for the job. We may not be good enough. But those aren't the things that define us. Those are just the circumstances that we find ourselves in. We can either let these doubts become who we are and take us down, or we can push into them and learn and grow. Instead of sticking with, "I'm not the right person for this," we can maybe ask, like, "What is needed from me right now, and in what ways can I fulfill that or provide that?" And instead of saying, "I'm not good enough," we can ask, "How can I grow?" Our doubts can lead us into deeper places of faith and trust in others, in ourselves, and in God. Doubt and faith can coexist. I mean, they do it all the time. But then what do we do when our doubt and our fear become so great that that's all we see? Like, can a person have too many doubts? Like, is there a level? How much is too much? So most of the time when I've heard the passage from today, I hear people talk about this last verse here, about how all you need is faith the size of a mustard seed. I think it's supposed to be this, like, inspiring thing, right? Like, a mustard seed isn't that big. God isn't asking for that much. But if I'm honest, most of the time, I don't know if I even have that much faith. Like, when I'm deep in my doubts and my fear and my anxiety, even finding a small amount of faith feels like a monumental task. And I don't know about you, but I have yet to ask a mountain to move and, like, see it actually do it. I mean, like, I actually have tried ask the mountains to move, but they stay suspiciously still. So, yeah, like, sometimes a mustard seed amount of faith can actually feel like a really big ask. A few years ago, I was talking with a friend of mine who's been here before, Tim Hawkins, and he had a different take on this idea. So we were talking about doubts, and we were talking about the story of Peter walking on water. So for those who may be unfamiliar with the story, Jesus has just fed over 5,000 people using a child's leftover lunch, and he goes off by himself for a moment of rest and prayer. And in the meantime, the disciples are in a boat, and they're crossing the lake. And so that night, while the disciples are still in the boat, they see Jesus walking on water next to them. So naturally, they all freak out and assume he's a ghost. But then Peter actually gets out of the boat and starts walking on water. Halfway there, he realizes what is happening, and he begins to doubt, and then he begins to sink. He cries out to Jesus, who then pulls him up and puts him back in the boat. So we're talking about this story, and Tim mentions to me that the only other time in the book of Matthew that the word doubt is used is in the last chapter, the section that most of us know as the Great Commission, which Katie actually talked about last week. So at this point in the story, Jesus has already risen from the dead, and he's with the disciples on a mountain, and Jesus tells them, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything I have commanded you. And surely I'm with you always to the very end of the age." So this is the part of the story, right, that most of us are pretty familiar with. But if you back up to the two verses before, it says this: "Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountain where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshiped him, but some doubted." But some doubted. And I know that Katie spoke about this last week, but it's worth repeating. After everything that the disciples have been through, there is still doubt. They are literally standing with the resurrected Jesus, and there is still doubt. I mean, honestly, if any time in your life you're going to be sure about something, you would think that would be the moment. And yet there is still doubt. But Jesus doesn't seem to mind. Even to the doubters, he says, "Go forward and tell people about this. It's okay. Trust in me and trust in your previous experiences with me. Bring the doubts along with you. There's plenty of room." Because at the end of the day, even with their doubts, the disciples still came to the mountain to worship. Even with his doubts, while he was out there on that water, Peter still cried out to God. So maybe it's not you need this much faith to do something. Maybe it's actually here's how much room there is for your doubts and your fears to join us on this journey. What if you only need enough faith to cry out to God? What if you only need enough faith to come to the mountain? What if you only need enough faith to show up? What if the faith you have is the mustard seed? It's not that you need more to meet the mark. You just need to acknowledge what's already there and that it's enough. So there's one final thing that I see happening in this story with the disciples. I see their fear of failure. I see their doubts in not being good enough. I see their desire to cry out to God, but I also see a misplaced trust. Have you ever done something so many times that, like, it becomes second nature, right? Like when you're driving home from work or the grocery store or something, and then you realize you don't even remember the drive because you were just, like, on autopilot. Or, like, maybe you've, like, cooked something so many times that, like, you couldn't even repeat a recipe because you just know it by, like, feel, smell, taste. Sometimes I think we do this when it comes to faith. Like, we can become so capable in something that we forget about God. And as a person who works in vocational ministry, like, I 100% do this. I can write a curriculum for a small group, like, in my sleep. And it'll probably even be decent. But I've been doing this almost weekly for about 12 years now. So I can pretty easily guess, like, which questions are going to land, which are going to be, like, bridge questions, what maybe people in the group need to hear. And I can do all of that without God being present at all. But when I take the time to actually pray over the words and the text and the message, and pray for the people in the space who will be part of the conversation, ask for guidance and wisdom with what people need to hear, then that small group becomes a completely different space. In those times, those conversations are almost guaranteed to extend beyond the space that we're in and permeate through the group's week. The people involved are much more likely to participate in the weekly challenge that we put in front of them. And we may not even have to ask the questions because the conversation's so involved and engaging that we don't really need prompts. And most importantly, I can walk away with the knowledge and trust that what was said and what was heard was from God and not my own thoughts or opinions. See, the disciples have healed people before. They've been active participants in Jesus' miracles. Like, this is not new to them. But maybe this time around, they trusted so much in their own abilities that they forgot to trust in God. Maybe they were so concerned about measuring up that they missed the step where they're supposed to ask God for help. Maybe they forgot about the God part. So trust and faith are important, but who we're putting that trust in and where we're placing that faith are vital. When we put our trust in God, it will never be misplaced, even if it ends up looking different than what we wanted it to. The beauty of the resurrection that we celebrated 2 weeks ago is that it didn't just happen one time. Resurrection and newness happen every day and in every moment. All we have to do is muster enough faith to come to the mountain and to cry out to God. And in those spaces, we'll get to worship with the resurrected Christ. Will you pray with me? Lord, may we be a community that puts our trust in you. Let us know that there's plenty of room for our doubts and our fears when you ask us to follow you. Help those things lead us to draw closer to you and not keep us further away. May we see the faith that already exists within us and trust that this is the mustard seed that you talk about, that just showing up here today is enough. And even when that feels like too much to ask, help us trust that crying out to you is also enough. When we doubt who we are and if we're good enough, may we never forget that it was you who named us your beloved. Amen.